You're listening to World Oil Deep Dive, conversations with energy industry leaders and engineers about the market trends and technologies shaping the oil and gas industry. Now, here's this week's episode.
All right, everybody, I am Jim Watkins, and today we're here with Pat Garcia, the Energy Transition Director at Parker Wellbore. Pat, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jim. I've listened to your podcast, so I appreciate being on your show.
It's fantastic to have you here because we're talking about energy transition things today. So it's going to be very exciting. I mean, a hot topic, a lot of people interested in it. Before we dive into that, tell us a little bit about your background and how you became the director of energy transition here at Parker.
Sure. Well, thanks for asking that question. It's sort of I have a unique background because I'm a lawyer by profession. But you never know with your career where you're going to end up. And so with me, you know, coming out of law school, I did do the MBA, studied law. Right out of law school, I began as a prosecutor, an assistant district attorney, a federal prosecutor, assistant U.S. attorney. And then as part of that, I did a lot of trial work and then moved into one of these kind of larger law firms serving global clients. And being here in Texas, obviously, you know, you're going to serve the oil industry. So I sort of made the transition, went in-house, moved around a few times, went to Cameron, then Schlumberger, when they acquired Cameron. And then I left the industry for the telecom industry. I moved over to Europe for 3 years.
So I was
So I was in Amsterdam for 3 years from 2017 and came to Parker in January 2020, which was sort of an interesting journey because I started at Parker a long time ago. So Parker's a great company. So it was great to come back. And that's how I got back to Houston. In terms of this role, how I began was we began working on our ESG report back in 2021. And we decided, we said, okay, how are we going to do our first report? It was our inaugural report. And I sort of chaired that group that was doing it. And I led that whole process to get our first report out. And especially being in the energy industry, oil field services, a large chunk of that was dedicated to the environmental side because that's pretty significant for us. So as I got into it, I really found that, hey, I really like doing this. I really like trying to figure things out and solve problems. And we decided as a company, we said, you know, with the way things are going, we need to form an energy transition group. So a lot of this is new. You know, got the ESG report coming out. Then we decided on this energy transition business segment. Well, we started looking around and what we found was, you know, you would get people in and you talk to them, a lot of great people, but they would be very focused on one area. Maybe they're geothermal experts. Maybe they're kind of getting into hydrogen or they've done enhanced oil recovery to help with the carbon capture side. But there's so many different areas that it's like, well, wait a minute. Nobody really has a grasp on any one, all of them.
Right.
You know, so let me just try to throw my name in the hat and I put it out there. And then that's why I said, you never know where your career is going to take you because the next thing you know, we're off and running.
Yeah. Don't ask if you don't want to be in charge,
right?
That's the thing. That's exciting. And we'll get into that a little bit about how that strategy developed. But I think most of our listeners know Parker Wellbore and know what you guys do. But give us a little brief on that.
Yeah. No, the audience, I'm sure, is familiar with Parker. I mean, one thing I'll say is we've been around for almost a century, since 1934. I mean, I think we have a reputation for going into harsh environments, environmentally sensitive environments. We've won a number of awards over the years. A lot of our business is international with respect to our drilling, but also we've sort of evolved into this one Parker model where we're coming in and offered bundled packages. In about 2013, we purchased a small group called ITS, and they brought together a lot of their rental work in Europe, a lot of what they were doing in the Middle East, the tubular running services, just a lot of things that we brought to it. We've come in now from fishing to all kinds of things to say, we can offer you a one Parker package, not just bring the rig, operate the rig, but we could add in all these services around it. And so that's sort of where we've evolved into Parker Wellbore and Wellbore Construction. But otherwise, I think many people are familiar with us from our former name, Parker Drilling.
Yeah.
And we made the change a few years ago to kind of reflect where we are and how we're evolving with the market.
Yeah, that's an amazing transition into being able to offer like a one-stop shop, basically, for Wellbore things, and makes sense. I mean, because everybody did know Parker Drilling right before, and that wasn't doing justice to what you guys are up to these days. And especially when we talk about this, right? Because your guys push into the energy transition space and the things you were doing there. Talk us a little bit about through how that happened. How'd you go from being like, hey, we're traditionally drilling holes for oil and gas to this energy transition, like you were saying, set up the ESG thing, set up a panel, and then put a whole group together behind that. How did that thinking happen inside?
Yeah. So no, that's a really good question. So you know, one of the things about my former role in legal is I was reporting into the audit committee and to the board, and then dealing with, our CEO, Sandy Esselmont, very bold, very visionary, and just thinking about where we are in the market. And we sat back and looked at our company. And you think about, I mentioned being around since 1934, over the years, that sort of knowledge and expertise and those competencies, they sort of passed along and been codified down through our processes and everything we do. So we had such strong, rich history and such knowledge. We have great engineers, great drillers, just everything. And so we said, you know, we see what's going on in the market, and how do we get involved in this a little bit more? And one of the interesting things was, people have been talking energy transition for a long time, but when you look at our geothermal work, we've been doing it for over 40 years. So we're already operating geothermal. Right. So we said, okay, we looked at that and we said, okay, we're in this already. But the other thing to think about is, what are our customers doing? We tend to work with tier one customers, you know, your larger integrated oil companies that are going out there. And really, when you're thinking about strategy, people always come in and they'll say, well, we want to double revenue. That's a vision. That's a goal. That's not a strategy. And the first thing is, you got to make assumptions about where the market is going, what demands looks like. And the best strategy you could have is listening to your customers.
Absolutely.
Because you got to think about, where is the customers going? And so when you look at what's happening in the market, we're still focused on oil and gas, and that's going to be around for a long time. But we also said, let's go ahead and leverage our experience in that industry and start getting into this energy transition business, which we've already been doing on the geothermal side.
Right.
And now we're doing a carbon capture project. We got other things going on. But this is sort of the thinking, that how we evolved into where we are today.
Yeah, because all of the majors and the NOCs internationally, everybody's got some resources dedicated to that, right? Because they're thinking the same way. It's like, hey, where is the whole energy thing going? You know, how can we lower our emissions? Let's start looking at some of these projects that you guys are involved in. So that's a great way to follow the customer and be real partners for the customer, because otherwise they would have to go out and find somebody else who had some expertise in geothermal or carbon capture or something else. So you're like, hey, we have it right here.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, Jim. And you hit the nail on the head when you talked about emissions, because, you know, as I was talking a little earlier to you, you know, the game is not necessarily about oil, but it's about emissions. And so when you think about our fleet, what we could offer to the customers, we could do electric, right? You do a high line switch gear if we're talking about electric. If we're talking about going into certain areas, we have the competencies and abilities to kind of meet the demands of the market. And that's sort of why we sort of evolved and put this business together as we do now.
Let me jump in here for a quick reminder. Be sure to join us for the Gulf Energy Information Excellence Awards on October 11, 2023, at the Post Oak Hotel in Houston, Texas. This premier black tie gala highlights advancements and leadership in the global energy industry. Network, celebrate, and register at gulfenergyinfo.com/events.
So tell us, okay, long, long history of traditional drilling. So what are the competencies? I mean, obviously, you guys know a lot about directional drilling and all of these things. Which of the competencies from straight oil and gas really transfer over to today's, you know, energy transition things like carbon capture or geothermal, those type of things?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And really, it's our focus on the subsurface. Our guys know the subsurface better than anybody. So when we think about the subsurface and we think about how we developed this strategy, what we did was we said, what is it that we know? How to leverage what we know about the subsurface and bring that over. So for us, we don't play in areas that we're not going to bring value to our customer, right? Because our value proposition is to minimize risk and optimize performance. And how can we do that for our customer and help them solve their challenges is through giving them options on things that we know how to do. So we focused our strategy on things that we know, the subsurface being the carbon capture, as you mentioned, being the geothermal, plug and abandonment, and then the emissions reduction technology. And then there's some other things we do in Europe, which are related to what we call the economic life cycle, or circular economy is the new term that we use for reusing assets. But when you think about what we bring to the table, is we bring all of this and we said, let's go out and stay with what we know and figure out. And if you look at carbon capture, well, if you're talking about where we play, we're in the Gulf Coast. We have barge rigs. We have H barge rigs. We're the number one barge rig fleet provider in the United States.
Wow.
Yeah, we have a great team out there, fantastic group. I mean, just tremendous experience. And when you look at the geological formations, when you look at kind of what's going on with storage and what they call point source industrial emissions, where they're capturing the emissions and they're storing it, we're there. We have the ability to do that. We're doing a project now. And that involves drilling. That involves re-injecting the CO2. And when you think about that, it's actually a blue hydrogen project.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so they're doing what's called, you know, hydrogen's interesting because with hydrogen, you're using another energy source. So you're using natural gas, steam methane reforming, where they take the natural gas and they're taking out the CO2 and we're able to drill down and they're going to re-inject that into the ground. And so when you look at that, we said, okay, that's sort of in our ballpark. We know how to do that. We have something to offer. And it's the same thing with geothermal. We've been doing geothermal for 40 years, as I mentioned, out in Asia, but not just in Asia. We've been in Hawaii. We've been in the Ascension Islands. We've been in the Philippines. We've been in New Zealand, just doing a lot in that area. And I was just in Indonesia, and I'm going back next month where we have a fantastic customer out there that we're working for. And that's another area where we said was, hey, listen, we know how to do this. Now, there's a lot of new things going on in geothermal, enhanced geothermal systems, and there are people we were talking about, they're shooting lasers down to try to figure out different ways. They're doing multilaterals. All those look promising. We've said, let's focus on what we know right now, and then let's look at the market. As the market evolves, if we could offer value to our customers at a price that's going to be competitive, then we'll go into these markets and do that. But right now, we're still focused on our traditional geothermal hard rock drilling, where we're going on and bringing that to the customer. And that's been very successful for us.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing because I'm no technical expert, but the formations where you drill for geothermal things, the rock is different. It's not shale. It's not these other things, right? So is that a challenge that's easily overcome? I mean, what do? Do you get like, I don't know, do you have to change out bits more frequently? I mean, the heat has to be different. I mean, there's a lot of challenges in there, aren't there?
There are challenges. And when you think about where we're at right now, the Asia Pacific Ring of Fire, that area, the easiest way to think about it is the volcanic activity, the hard rock, when it's closer to the surface. Because one of the great things about geothermal, it's heat beneath our feet. It's everywhere.
Right.
So, you know, you see a lot of companies now going into sedimentary, looking at, can we do this here? Can we do this there? And if you look at where geothermal is in the United States, it's mostly focused on the western United States, Nevada, California, places where it's easier to access. So there are some challenges around accessing the heat at a, you could do it. There's sometimes the cost can be a little higher when you're trying to go down. So you got to make sure that, are you getting this at the right cost, at the right price point to be able to offer it to the customers, and where it's, where we could access it a little easier. It's not just in Asia, but you think about Iceland, where, and I mean, you go back in history and even in Italy where people were, you know, you, those stories of people, the Romans taking steam baths.
Absolutely.
Right? So that's an area for us where our guys out there just know so much. They go in and they give master classes on how to do this because they've been doing it so long.
Right.
And bringing that knowledge and trying to see where else can we apply it has been something that we've been looking at. And I think that I'm really optimistic about geothermal growing. It's only 1%, as we talked about, of the mix, but it's a renewable. And one thing we're looking at too, Jim, and I think this is worth, which is interesting, is there's a lot of these abandoned, inactive wells out there, right? And so we've been in talks with different partners about being execution partners and about being delivery partners on going in and repurposing some of these abandoned wells that they need to go into, because, and bringing heat out of it at a lower cost so that we could bring direct heat using geothermal. And there's actually many applications for that, because when you think about these old wells, well, about 25% of these well bores exhibit some type of sustained casing pressure, which is an indication that there's methane leakage.
Right.
And methane is really ultra potent when it comes to what its impact on the atmosphere. So when you think about what we could do is, not only can we help with these old abandoned wells, but we could also help stop methane leakage, and we could find different areas to do that. And I think we're also seeing that in the carbon capture space, where one of the biggest things that's happening in the carbon capture world is the concerns always about when you take the CO2 down, they want to make sure it doesn't plume, it doesn't kind of go out of its hard rock area. And so you got to sometimes go back in and re-P&A, re-plug and abandon those wells around it. And so that's another area where, when you think about our value proposition of knowing the subsurface and having subsurface experts, that's where we play below ground. And that's where we bring the value. Now, I know, Jim, that some of our competitors are getting into solar and wind. And what I've always said is, God bless everyone that are doing it. You know, I hope they all work. And I think what we've realized is that we need a mix of everything to
bring
it all down. There's not going to be a one-stop shop. It's not going to be one solution. I think that's what we're thinking about and how we see the transition.
Yeah. And the curious thing is that when you talk about wind or solar, well, you got to have wind or you got to have sun to have it. But the geothermal, that's always on, right? And that's always one of the big bugaboos about renewable energy, right? I mean, is it available on demand? And if you can set up a geothermal well properly, that's producing all the time. Rain, snow, wind, whatever. It doesn't matter,
right? You hit the nail on the head, Jim. That's baseload energy. It's constant. And the other thing, when I go back to this repurposing, what's happening right now is it takes up a lot of space to develop some of these solar panels and put them on land. Well, when you think about some of these smaller geothermal projects, there's opportunity there to go in and say, hey, look, we could bring you this constant baseload energy with smaller assets taking up less room. And this is this whole challenge for the energy industry, Jim, is how are you going to do all of this? It's like you were saying, a plane can't fly on wind or the sun, right?
Right.
So you're going to have to figure out some different ways to deal with it. And that's why we think that carbon capture is going to provide some value, because at the end of the day, it's going to take a long time. And if the game's about emissions, it's the best way to get emissions down while you're trying to make this transition. Because, Jim, if you think about where we started as a human society, we went from wood burning to coal to oil. You know, it's evolved for a long time. And we're trying to do this quickly in a world where about 85% of our economies revolve around fossil fuels.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I mentioned India, for example, where India, you know, they're still using coal. They're going to be using coal, you know, until 2060 probably. So because people have to live. So how do we do this in a responsible way to capture those emissions? And that's how we think that we bring some value to this whole climate problem that we're trying to deal with.
The interesting thing for me when I think about it is, like, I always wondered about P&A because, I mean, there's been a big emphasis on that because of the methane and whatnot. But like you said, if you're going to use the reservoirs for carbon capture, you got to make sure all that stuff's plugged up, right? So all of these things play together. It's not one thing and another thing. It's not like, oh, now it's P&A time. We're worried about getting fines for methane leaks or whatever.
Right.
We're just going to go out and plug everything. Well, why would you do that when, you know, if you have somebody who understands the reservoir, you can be like, okay, we'll plug these, we'll keep this one, because then we can extract the energy that's still down there, right? That type of thing.
And Jim, the other thing too is that Gulf Coast area, when you think about where we're set up in the Gulf Coast, United States, where our barge rigs are. I was in Norway and they were talking about how, looking at the world, where's the best place for storage? I mean, the world is looking at us saying, look at this area here, and you have all these industries there, and it's a way to be able to help, you know, with these, what they call them, emitters,
right,
to try to figure out, how are you going to reach your net zero goals? Everybody's hitting these, putting out these targets. Well, we're offering something, because there are some alternatives, Jim, that people are looking at, but it's also the issue of the cost. How are you going to do these in a cost competitive way? Because you're trying to bring energy to the market in an affordable way, because we have a society that needs to live and needs to rely on energy to live.
Yeah. And as much as we like to have everything be renewable, I mean, we talked about this a little bit before, it's just not possible yet. The technology isn't there. The investment isn't there. But the other thing is we like affordable energy.
That's
what everybody wants. That's why India will be on coal, because that's the most affordable thing. And as humans, I mean, that's what we gravitate towards. So as we start making this transition, I mean, you know, it's like everything. It's like an oil and gas. You know, the cost curve is dramatic. The longer you're involved with it, the more technologies you get involved, the cost just drops off. You know, it's like a hockey stick in reverse, right? The cost just drops. I think in the future that this is going to be the main point, right? Is we need to make these investments up front. It's not going to happen overnight. None of our energy transition as a globe has ever happened overnight, right? And it's always going to be a mix, you know?
Right.
I mean,
hopefully
somewhere way down the road, oil and gas won't be 85%. Maybe we'll only be 50%. And, you know, the rest will make up. But, I mean, we got to get working on it. An interesting question, because this is a funny one. But the Inflation Reduction Act, how does that play on the whole energy transition thing?
So the Inflation Reduction Act, what's interesting is it's hit its one-year anniversary about this time. And a lot of that still needs to kind of go into regulations. And it started out as, I'll tell you from a global view and from a more of a United States perspective, for the carbon capture business, it's helped because of this $85 a credit for point source industrial emissions and $185 a credit for direct air capture. That has helped in a way, because what do you do when it's almost a waste business, right?
Right.
When you're selling oil, you're selling something, a commodity out in the market, you're putting emissions down. How do you really pay for that? It's a very expensive proposition to not just capture it, which is one thing, remove it, then transport it, then store it down underground, right? That's a lot of different value chains working together, and seeing kind of carbon capture as a service has evolved over time. Because really, without government kind of coming in to try to help stimulate some things, what is the incentive for the customer to do this?
Absolutely.
Right? And so it's a tough thing to do. Now, that is a positive. There are some things with the Inflation Reduction Act, as you know, is that are not so positive that I see. For instance, the government is not good at picking winners and losers because they're putting a lot of push on green hydrogen, and that's what they're doing in Europe. But here in the U.S., we see a lot more value in the blue hydrogen because you have the natural gas,
right.
You capture the emissions. So there's a little bit of that going on. You could sense that. And it's just such a huge bill. I mean, trying to kind of figure out kind of where to go with it. But it has, on a global perspective, stimulated some of the other economies out in the world to say, we need to move faster because the United States is now kind of leading in this effort. When you look at something like this, when you have massive government spending, sometimes there are some problems. I don't know if people remember like Solyndra back in 2005 period where the government's betting on one. You really need the free market to do that. And so what you're going to have happen in this transition is you're going to have some startups go and some startups fail. But ultimately, that doesn't mean you shouldn't play in the transition. You need to position yourself to say, like, kind of what we did was, where can we bring some value to this transition using what we know, and what do we think is going to be viable? Because when you look at kind of these startups and what they're doing, it's one thing to do things in a lab. Okay, if it works there, then you got to go out and do it in the field. Will it work there? Then you got to think, okay, can I scale this the way oil does, right?
Yeah,
can I do this repetitively over and over on a grand basis with some volume? That's the other thing. And then at the end of the day is, what's the cost, right? Because you talk about green hydrogen, and that's a process with electrolyzers where you're using water, and that's still very expensive. So again, I've made this clear, like, I believe in all these different energy sources. I hope they all work because we need all of them.
Yeah.
But it's going to take some time to get that cost curve down so that we could do something, even nuclear. People have talked about nuclear, but it's a huge process. It takes a long time. It takes permits. And going back to your question about the Inflation Reduction Act, we put everything out there to do it. But one of the challenges we've seen is that everybody's ready to go, and then we're all ready to work, and then we get permit issue delays.
Bingo. Yeah.
And so this is tough because when you're running a business and you've planned and you're putting resources aside and you're doing what you do as a business to try to be prudent, but then you can't get off the ground because it takes a couple of years for our customers to get permits and they're trying really hard. This is a problem that has gone on for a while now. And I know they've tried to fix it recently and they're doing some things, and that's good progress, but we still have some more permit reform we need to do to try to make sure that we can meet these climate goals.
Oh, absolutely. I was just at a conference yesterday and this whole permitting issue came up, right? Because especially on the carbon capture side, I mean, there's so many questions around that, right? It's like, wait a second, how long as an operator am I responsible for that stuff that's downhole, right? Because you want it to stay down there forever.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
But no company is going to take on the liability of forever, right?
Right?
And so figuring that out, how do you build the regulations? Okay, you know, it's one thing when you're taking energy out. It's another thing when you're putting it in. And how do you get those permits? And I was listening to somebody from the Department of Energy talking, and that was the biggest complaint during her talk, right? At the end was, hey, we're all ready to go technology-wise. We're getting everything together. You know, what about the permits? I think that was 2 years ago. I think the previous year they'd issued one permit, and I think 14 people had put in for them, and they issued one.
Yeah.
You know, you got to have that. And I don't even know what permitting around geothermal looks like. Is that difficult as well?
Well, you have to understand that you have the local regulations you're dealing with too, right? So you think about the federal stuff, then you have the local things, and then, you know, you go in and you deal with this. It's just so many different obstacles to try to get to where you need. And you're trying to do what the world is asking us to do. They want us to go out and bring carbon-free energy. And that's what geothermal is. We're trying to reduce emissions. And in order to do this, we really need to focus on how do we come in and do this in a way where we could sort of accelerate the permit process.
Because
I understand we want to make sure we're not destroying the environment. We want to make sure we're not doing anything to hurt disadvantaged communities as we go out and do things and on a larger picture, right? I'm talking about the whole industry. But there's got to be a way to do this where we could double check and triple check things in a more faster process, because otherwise we're going to be talking about permits in 10 years and it's still at the same target levels that we're trying to reach.
Right.
Because we're still stuck with trying to do that. And it hurts business. It hurts capital flow into the industry too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because if you're going to make an investment, you're not sure if it's going to get stuck in a permit for 2-3 years issue, then that's going to cause some problems. So I think if we could overcome that, and I really think that people need to see that, you know, the oil industry, we have a lot of expertise, we have a lot of experience to offer. You know, this demonizing the industry, there's really no reason for that, because I think that a lot of people don't understand. We love the environment just like everyone else. We want to see what's best for the environment. We have great people who take good care of the environment. The oil industry actually has a lot of, you know, people that love the outdoors. Yeah. I mean, this is something that when you think about us as an industry, we really have a lot to offer here. So this notion that they don't want to give permits because they don't like carbon capture, they think it's prolonging dirty energy is what I've heard some bureaucrats say. Yeah, I've heard bureaucrats say this. I've had to spend a lot of time. I've spent time going to Washington, D.C. You know, I'm just kind of trying to figure out how do we get around some of these things. And I think there really has to be a mindset change on what we could bring to help get us to net zero as a globe. And then as the United States, it's also an issue of competition too.
Right.
Right. I mean, right now, you know, when you talk about other areas we're looking at, Jim, we're actually looking at what can we do in the lithium market?
Right.
Because when we talk about geothermal, as a result of what's happening now with all these EVs is causing a demand for critical minerals.
Correct.
Yeah. And, you know, your cobalt, copper, lithium, and some of those are in some not so friendly places around
right.
the world, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, through the brine process, we could access lithium. And now the question is, all right, well, how can we do this in a way that's going to help with all this demand for EVs coming on market, where Ford's making announcements, Toyota's made announcements? Well, you're going to have a lot of EVs coming on the market. You're going to have a lot of infrastructure needs. You're going to have a lot of mineral needs.
Right.
And so this is another area where I think the oil industry could really help out. Someone like us that knows how to drill, knows how to get to geothermal, and our customers understand they have the processing capabilities to extract the brine, the lithium from the brine. And so there's this emerging markets that are coming up in the future where we really could help. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't know and don't talk about. That's why I said, I wish we would get to the point where we're not demonizing the industry,
right,
but working together to move the country forward.
And it's crazy. I mean, that anyone would demonize the industry that's giving you 85% of your energy, right? I mean, for me, that's crazy. I understand saying, hey, man, you know, we got to figure a transition away from this. But to not lean, like I've heard of government contracts not being given to oil and gas companies for things like geothermal and stuff like that, because they're like, hey, man, you're dirty. You're oil and gas. We don't want to have a contract with you, which is just wrong thinking, because then you're denying all the expertise and experience that those companies have, and you're denying them the ability to transition to new energy themselves, yeah, which they have to do. I mean, these are big organizations, ongoing concerns, and they're going to be providing most of your energy for our lifetimes.
Right.
So you want to help them get across as well. But I think the permitting thing is the key. I mean, if there was enough stress that I think, you know, they could speed that up. You know what I mean? Whether it's hiring more people or having more experts internally to review things or doing whatever. I mean, when push comes to shove, if you really need to get it done, if it was like a Manhattan Project type situation, right?
Yeah.
They could straighten that out. And we're just not quite there yet, right? We're not quite there yet. But think about everything that's been going on. Think about Hawaii, you know, stuff like that.
If we're starting to see more climate adaptation, people moving, more climate impact, and they want to move, I think there needs to be a realization that we have to also help with the bottlenecks.
Absolutely.
It's no different from the grid, right?
With right.
The transmission lines. If we're going to have all these EVs come into market, we better make sure we have stable grids. And we're going to have to check if a lot of those grids still run on the old sources like coal, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so how are you going to think about that? So getting to your point, you're absolutely right. The other thing I'd say is you think about a company like Parker, we bring project execution experience. We bring that. I mentioned the subsurface experience, project management experience. I mean, imagine how we could help this transition if people would think about us in a way that is positive as an industry, that we're not here just to hurt the environment. We actually want to help the environment. And we believe that climate change presents an existential threat, and we're here to help move the world forward. And that's the way we got to come together.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I honestly don't know. I mean, I talked to a different bunch of organizations, you know, lobbyists in DC and whatnot. And I just don't think, I mean, for our industry, the resources we have, I think we've done a terrible job at messaging. You know, we let little environmental groups that have a fraction of the resources we have take over the story, right? About energy and energy transition. And here's a funny thing. I just got to throw this in, but I was reading a story in the New York Times the other day, and they were talking about wind farms and solar transition stuff, and how now some of the biggest opponents are the environmental groups, right? Because now it's like, wait a second, man, you want to take over all this acreage and set up these wind farms? That's going to disrupt all kinds of things. And what do you mean you're going to cover thousands of acres with solar panels? You can't do that. You know, there's animals living there and whatnot. And so, I mean, everybody has to work together and come on board. But for us, who knows? Maybe that'll be my retirement job. I'm going to start one big PR agency for the whole energy
thing
where we can have lobbyists and we can have TV commercials and talk about it, because I know my daughter, she graduated from Cornell a couple of years ago, and I sat in on a class there. It was on energy policy. And these kids, man, they hated oil and gas.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. They were on me in a second. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm not even really oil and gas. I work for a media company that serves oil and gas. But all of their arguments were the same false arguments that you hear all the time, right?
Yeah.
And so if we can just sit down and talk to people and say, hey, why don't we all work together? And yeah, us too, we can help. We want to help, right? I think that'll make a big difference in the future. But now put on your thinking cap, Pat. Give us a little futuristic. What is the crystal ball? What is the energy transition going to look like 5-10 years from now?
Well, I think for the transition, there's going to be, so as we go along, I think we're going to continue to see a change in the perception, like you said. I think people are now coming to realize that we're going to need more than one solution. I think that they've come to realize that it's not going to be, we're just going to wipe out oil and move away. And I think the other thing that's going to happen in terms of technology, I think what we're going to see is, you know, we have a lot of this talk about AI and how AI fits in. Well, if you think about, you know, AI, if you have an electric car right now, it'll tell you how much battery you have. When I lived in Europe, I could use my phone back in 2017 to go find, I lived in Amsterdam, so we rode bikes.
Right.
But, you know, if you need a drive, you just take your phone, you look for the nearest EV car is, you could rent it there, you could find out where's a local charging station, whether it's full, how much battery time. So, you know, you have this technology and it's sort of advanced over time. But I think now we're going to start seeing that move to the grids, where you're going to start seeing some tracking or some ability to try to talk about, okay, this is how much renewables this grid is using, or you could get your energy from here. I think we're going to have more of that sort of decentralization going on that side. On the oil and gas side, I think, you know, we're going to contribute a lot still. I am optimistic on the geothermal side. I think that 1% number has a lot of potential to grow, because when you're down, I always say when you're at 1%, you can't go any lower.
You can only go up,
You can only go up. So I think that's another area. So I think there's more to come from us. And I think I wouldn't write off a group, especially like Parker Wellbore, where you have a tremendous amount of experience to bring to the market. So that's where I'm seeing us going.
All right, Pat. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. And yeah, I'm excited to see what that future rolls out, you know, how it rolls out. But you guys here at Parker, you definitely have a lot to contribute to the energy transition. So
yeah, no, thank you. I mean, I think my only last words for any companies listening out there is just be bold, because there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be reluctant to go into things. And I think that you're going to have a lot of in companies, you have a lot of analysts that like to, you know, look at things and talk about
lawyers,
you
know, this. Lawyers.
Lawyers especially, right? We're the worst. Don't do this, don't do that. But I think to make this transition happen, you need to be bold. You need to take some strategic bets. You need to take some risks. So I think that'll be something that we need to look at for the future too.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Pat.
Thanks, Jim. I appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning into our show. Please check out the show notes for the links we discussed in the podcast. We value your opinions, so if you have any questions or comments, kindly email them to us at deepdive@worldoil.com. Additionally, we'd appreciate it if you could rate us on your preferred podcast listening app. Lastly, don't forget to visit worldoil.com for the latest technical articles and news about the oil and gas industry.